Welcome to the Washington AI Network podcast. I'm Tammy Haddad, the founder of the Washington AI Network, where we bring together official Washington, D.C. insiders and AI experts who are challenging, debating, and just trying to figure out the rules of the road for artificial intelligence. This is an exciting podcast from the Center for AI Safety's D.C. launch event. Varun Krovi, who runs the Center for AI Safety Action Fund, let us record the program with Dan Hendricks and Jan Talin and Hawaii Senator Brian Schatz. Unfortunately for me, I got COVID and could not attend. But fortunately for you, the great CNN anchor Pamela Brown filled in to interview these AI leaders. Thank you, Pamela. The episode begins with Varun introducing Arkansas Congressman French Hill. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the launch reception of the Center for AI Safety. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here. I'm Varun Krovi, Executive Director of the Center for AI Safety Action Fund. It is my honor to introduce Congressman French Hill from Arkansas. The Congressman serves as the Vice Chair of the House Financial Services Committee. He serves as Chairman of the Subcommittee on Digital Assets, FinTech, and Inclusion. And relevant to today's event is the co-chair of the Bipartisan Working Group on AI. He also sits on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence and on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. We are delighted to welcome him here tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, Congressman French Hill.
Well, good evening, everybody. So glad to have you here for this important conference. Glad to be a small part of it. Senator, good to be with you. The conveners, thank you for all your dedicated work on spreading the word about how to do AI in an effective, appropriate, and safe and sound way when it comes to deployment across the United States and, of course, the globe. Because, you know, we're not going to turn the clock back. We're not going to turn the clock back on technical innovation in our country or around the globe, and we don't want to. We want innovation to proceed because we know over the long haul, it produces incredible benefits to all of our people. But we also don't want to put a rock on top of innovation either and not allow it to flourish under the right circumstances. So it's a balancing act. And frequently, both the private sector and the public sector have a role to play in that balancing act. But I think back to the mid-1990s. And in 1996, former Congressman, then Securities and Exchange Committee Chair, Chris Cox of California, put forward a House resolution that said, we're not going to tax or regulate the internet. We're going to let it flourish, and we're going to tax and regulate the activity on the internet. We're going to treat it like it is an open source operating system that has tremendous potential. We don't even know what that potential is. In fact, we're scared of the internet in 1996. You know, there's pornography on the internet. There are terrible influences out on the internet that's now going to come in through our extraordinary dial-up connection through AOL. In conjunction with that was also Congress's decision on the Telecommunications Act to facilitate competition. And without both Chris's resolution on what we think of as Web 1, the basic internet, and the Telecommunications Act of 1996, you would not have this in your pocket. And if you have it at your pocket, it would not be at the cost that you have it in your pocket. You wouldn't have the connectivity, you wouldn't have the cost, you wouldn't have the cell service, you wouldn't have the innovation. You would not have Web 1 and now Web 2 had it not been for that forethought of not putting a rock on top of now what we know is Web 1. So we're at another inflection point in business history, technological innovation history, in and around blockchain, Web 3, artificial intelligence. So once again, we step into the breach of this decision-making in the public and the private sector in the world's largest economy, most technologically advanced and entrepreneurial and flexible economy, which is the United States. Rock, no rock. I vote no rock. But I vote that we think about how to do this in the right way. And I've been engaged in the last 5 years, actually going on almost six now, then Chair Maxine Waters of California, and the Republicans had working groups on AI and fintech in 2019. So our members are among the most, I think, educated and thoughtful in and around AI on the House Financial Services Committee because of that 2019 working group, that then has turned into our FinTech subcommittee that I chair for the House Financial Services Committee today, our bipartisan working group on AI that now Ranking Member Waters and Chairman McHenry have set up, and the committee that Dr. Bill Foster from Illinois and I serve on behalf of Financial Services Committee of Hakeem Jeffries and Speaker Mike Johnson, our working group for the whole House. It's principles-based. What's that first principle? And we asked the regulators in financial services and HUD, the ones in our jurisdiction of financial services, how are you thinking about this? Are you using AI in your agencies? Yes, we're thinking about it. We're considering it. We're writing the guiding principles for that. Well, how are you thinking about it from a supervisory point of view for the banks, the broker-dealers, the HUD, housing-related topics, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? We are being principles-based, and we're saying they're not excused from any legal obligation they have in the analog world. So the first principle is, because you're choosing to use a large language model, machine learning, either on the compliance, back of the house side of your shop, or outbound, seeking new clients, better ways to do customer service, do fraud detection, or whatever, you're not exempt from your obligations under fair lending, fair credit reporting, the Community Reinvestment Act, et cetera, et cetera. Well, of course, we understand that. So the assumption is that we don't want to make an assumption of non-compliance because you're using machine learning. I think that's a false assumption. But, and this is where I think much of the work you're talking about comes in, how do you show your work? That is another guiding principle of the supervisory agencies. We want you to deploy AI in a safe and effective way, but we want you to show us your work. Show us how you are determining that this credit score or this advanced credit underwriting policy is in fact consistent with and compliant with fair lending law. So I think that's why you're seeing the private sector creep into this, particularly in regulated industries, rather than rush into it. There's a caution. So guiding principle one, that you're in compliance with current laws in the analog world, not this digital world, not a generative or non-generative world. And that you also, you have a person in the loop. And that as you refine that model and it performs better, you demonstrate that's the case as well. So both in the working group, in the House at writ at large, as well as the Financial Services Committee, that's a key takeaway. But there's more to be concerned about because we see it every day, I think, in our lives, if you listen, and that is the ability for AI results to be wrong. We took the entire intelligence committee to Lincoln Labs and MIT and spent 2 days with the scientists talking about both the pros and cons of artificial intelligence, quantum computing in an intelligence context, about what works and what doesn't work, what's dependable, what's not dependable, in order to gauge that from a national security point of view. And then Steve Lynch of Massachusetts and I took the Financial Services Committee to MIT to do the same. And you know what you walked away with? Caution. Because those results that you're so glibly putting in your query in ChatGPT, there may be a step beyond Wikipedia, but not much, depending on the question, depending on the prompt, depending on the query, depending on what time frame you're talking about. So a little suspicion is warranted. A second issue that I think merits careful thinking is the ability to completely use the concept of a deep fake out in a B2B, B2C context, even with the most sophisticated capabilities. I've seen an entire website in S1, and S1 is what you file when you go public, and a solicitation package that's every single aspect of it is completely made up. But man, as a guy who's been in investment banking, commercial banking for 4 decades, it's incredibly realistic. And if I was waiting around for this broker who says they work for this firm to tell me about this and say I'm eligible for this IPO, it's pretty good. Audio fake, video fake, there are ways to combat that. But these are the short-term risks, I think, that both commercial sector, the private sector, individuals, I think, are confronted with. So we're at these earliest days, and I want to commend the work here and the work of all of you, the interest that you're having, that we try to get this right. But we don't want to put a rock on the top of innovation. We want America to lead in this area. We don't want to over-regulate it, but we want to have the best practices available. And so on the House Financial Services Committee, that's what we're committed to on a bipartisan basis. We want to see AI advance. We want to see it benefit consumers. We want to see it benefit compliance. We want to see more opportunities for more people to have financial services product. We want to catch fraud faster. But I think in an American regulatory context, not in what I've seen in a European context. So I want to say thank you for the invitation to deliver a few opening remarks. I want to congratulate you on the great group that's assembled. Thank you for the incredible research and leadership you've demonstrated. And just express my appreciation. Our office is open to all of you. Anytime you want to come and talk about AI, AI oversight, or brainstorm that great direction to the future. So that Web3 is just as extraordinary as it comes to productivity, innovation, choices for consumers, choices for business. And just remember, we're not going backwards. We're going forward. And I credit the members of the House back in 1996 that took the right decision. And I feel certain that the members of the House and the Senate in this Congress and in the next Congress will take the right decisions to lead us into a future and one that we reap the benefits and that we understand the costs of artificial intelligence. Thanks for having me tonight. Thanks.
Thank you, Congressman. And now I'd like to introduce tonight's moderator, Pamela Brown. Pamela is the anchor of CNN's new weekday show, The Bulletin with Pamela Brown. She is an award-winning and Emmy-nominated journalist and also serves as CNN's chief investigative correspondent. We're delighted to welcome her as tonight's moderator. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Pamela Brown.
Thank you, Varun, for that warm introduction and for bringing us all together and for all of your leadership on AI. There is so much to discuss. We have an exciting program for everyone here tonight. It is now my honor to introduce our next special guest, Hawaii's Senior Senator Brian Schatz. Senator? He really needs no introduction, but I will anyway. Senator Schatz has been serving in the U.S. Senate since 2012. He is the chairman of the Indian Affairs Committee, and he currently serves on Appropriations, Commerce, and Foreign Relations Committees. And AI certainly touches on all of those. So I'm really excited to hear what you have to say, Senator. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for doing this.
All right. So let's start with AI safety. That's a big reason why we were here today together. How would you describe your outlook on the future development of AI?
Some combination of alarmed and optimistic. I think in the short run, French referred to some short-term sort of immediate risks. And I think fraud at scale is something that I think about in the immediate term. In the sort of medium to long term, I think you do have societal catastrophic risks. I think the nature of warfare, the nature of terrorism is something that our national security folks are going to have to do a deep dive into. But on the other hand, I'm a climate guy. I think it could resolve some of our grid management challenges. And I am terribly excited about two other areas, weather prediction and the ability to prepare for and respond to natural disasters. And I think the biopharmaceutical space is just going to be gobsmackingly optimistic and extend people's quality of life and actually the duration of their lives as well. But I think that everybody ought to be of two minds about this, that there really is both short-term acute risk to regular people. There are also some societal, economic, political risks that are unusual in the sense that they can go in a nonlinear fashion and perhaps get out of control. And yet, if you had a sick friend or loved one and somebody said, we've got this new technology that can analyze the human genome at a pace that nobody has ever contemplated before, you'd say, let's do that. And if we have all of these challenges, all this wonderful pent-up clean energy capacity, but really right now, not a way to distribute it in an efficient fashion, AI can help. My job is about compartmentalizing, and so I am now officially of two minds, alarmed and optimistic.
Yeah, and I think that's the right way to look at it, right? On one hand, it could potentially cure cancer. On the other hand, it could pose an existential threat to humanity, right? That's a reality. So the question is, how do you harness it for the good of humanity and mitigate the risk?
The first thing we need to do just as a Congress is get it out of our heads that we're going to resolve this with one piece of legislation. Because I think especially in tech policy, there's a kind of, yeah, well, what about this? And why don't we have a comprehensive bill? We're not going to get a comprehensive AI, one piece of legislation, and we're going to have to iterate this over many, many years. I don't think this is like the Telecommunications Act of 96. It's a different animal. The Telecommunications Act unleashed innovation because it broke up monopolies and enabled small companies to do really cool things. This is different than that. And so my view is attack those things that are immediate and upon us. I do think fraud at scale is one that we need to worry about. I have a very simple bill with Mark Warner and Susan Collins and John Kennedy that basically says anything made with generative AI that is on the internet has to have some sort of digital watermark, whether it's an audio file or a video file or just a still shot or whether it's prose. Let's start with the premise that if you're interacting with AI-generated content, that you are entitled to know that. And I think that will sort out a lot of what consumers are worried about in the very, very short run. And my own judgment is that we're going to have to start passing bills and not try to solve the whole problem, because we will be stroking our chins and thinking about this for another decade if we try to make the perfect the enemy of the good.
Let me follow up on that, because AI is rapidly developing, right? And just look at how it's developed in the past year and how it's impacting all of our lives. Congress, which I've covered for many, many years, is not known for acting with speed.
What?
So I think that is a factor here, right?
Yes.
And do you sense the urgency from your fellow members of Congress that this moment deserves?
Yes, I actually do. But I do think we get sucked into, well, what about this? And I've got another idea. And then it becomes this kind of Christmas tree bill. And I think we have to separate temporally, like what we're working on. And it seems to me that the most immediate issue is fraud and the inability to know whether something was made by a human or made by an AI. And that is something that I think we can do, that everybody seems to agree upon, and that even industry is having a hard time fighting. And then we have to kind of rack and stack and say, what else is a short-term threat or a short-term opportunity? There are incredible opportunities at, for instance, the FDA. So it's great if you can do this new analysis and put new drugs in the pipeline or new compounds for testing in the pipeline. But as long as the FDA still has administrative procedures and federal statutory law that are decades and decades old, then there's going to be a mismatch, not just on the kind of catastrophic or individual or societal risk, but also on the upside. If the government is not configured in a way that we can take advantage of all this new technology, then we're going to get a lot of private sector profitability and not a lot of public service improvement. And look, I've been listening a lot to folks who are worried about administrative burden, and those of us on the left want to solve every problem, right? But one of the things that I learned about administrative burden is during the COVID time, we were doing all these wonderful things for people. The only thing people really remembered and liked were the checks. Why? Because they were simple and they're quick, and you didn't have to do an eligibility determination. There is a scenario where an AI could actually be a kind of front door to the government, and you wouldn't need so much personal case management or technological or governmental literacy, that it could just start answering your questions and make things available to you that you were entitled to under the law. So there's a way to make the government work better using AI. And this is why, like every day when I think about AI, I get very, very excited and then I get very, very terrified.
So as we wait for the U.S. and policymakers to come together to figure out what the framework should be to regulate AI, what about AI companies? How much do you think they should self-regulate?
They are not self-regulating, and I think that's the problem. We wrote a letter to OpenAI, sent it out a day or so ago, it was published in the Post. I just don't think that it is reasonable to expect, when there is this much money at stake, for anyone to show any restraint when it comes to their own profitability. And that doesn't mean they're bad people. It doesn't mean that people within those companies aren't trying to do things. But the thing that was gobsmacking to me with OpenAI is that they hadn't even started, let alone completed their safety testing, and they were already planning their launch party. So they're figuring out catering and music, presumably, and everything else about their launch party, and they hadn't figured out whether the product was safe.
Do you think it's because of the competition and the AI race?
Absolutely. They are freaked out that they're going to get passed by. And this is what the government's for. You can be a libertarian or a Republican or a Democrat or anything in between. But the government is there first and foremost to keep people safe. And there are real risks here, and the government has to step up.
Obviously, you're well-versed in this. There are others. Congressman Hill just spoke. He's very well-versed. Do you think, though, that most policymakers are well-versed enough in artificial intelligence. And I ask that because I remember covering the hearings on social media. And some of it was hard to watch, frankly, because it was very clear that some of the members of Congress didn't really understand how it works.
It's a valid point. I think we all need to get better. And I've been, frankly, staffing up in the tech space because, look, you can be in the tech space, but it's tech or telecom or climate. And so you have to have a deeply expert staff in order to do this. But I want to push back a little bit on what my friend Chris Murphy calls tech shaming, which is to say, look, I'm also not a fighter pilot or a sailor or a soldier or an airman. And yet I am on the Defense Appropriations Committee, right? I am not a tribal member, and yet I'm the chairman of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. We are hired by our constituents to be generalists. And so I don't want the threshold to be so high that you have to come from Silicon Valley to make policy in this space. But you're right that we could all do a little better.
You mentioned some of the committees you're on, and one is the Foreign Relations Committee, of course. And I'm wondering what your thoughts on lethal autonomous weapons and talking to other countries about coming up with some sort of international treaty or agreement or framework on how to deal with that.
This is an area where the United States has to continue to be what Madeleine Albright called the indispensable nation. We absolutely need a framework for moral and just conduct in a war. That is an area where I am more alarmed, more concerned than perhaps any other area. Autonomous weapons that are driven by machine learning, where maybe the United States and maybe our allies have a certain set of guidelines, but it is not obvious to me that our adversaries would abide by those guidelines. So I think this is a very scary space, but it is no more scary than nuclear proliferation or conventions on chemical weapons. So there is a way we can get an international agreement in this space, but this is a place where the Foreign Relations Committee and the defense committees, I think, have a major role to play over the next year or so.
And you think an international agreement could include Russia, China, Iran? The reality is those countries could create that.
I don't know the answer to that, but obviously they're not party to some of the other treaties. But I think the more countries you can bring into the community of nations, adversary, a friend, or somewhere in between, the better.
I know you don't have a crystal ball, but if you look to the future, when do you see that actually being front and center?
Oh, I think this has to be over the next year or two. We are all wrapping our minds around the subject matter areas, the sort of stacks of lines of effort. But this is one where I think not enough work has been done. I know DOD and the State Department and a bunch of think tanks are working through this space, but we need to move from the thinking into the doing, into the diplomatic space so that this is a priority for the next president.
What makes you say that exactly? Are there certain data points? I know obviously you can get into classified intelligence, but what can you bring us into that?
This is not based on some briefing in the SCIF. This is based on how I understand warfare to be conducted and how I understand the intersection between kinetic engagement and an autonomous AI that keeps improving. It could get very, very scary, very, very fast. And to French's point, I didn't agree with everything he said, but I think putting a human in the chain at all times is really an essential aspect. And frankly, I used to have this argument with the social media companies, continue to, where I said, look, you need human beings to moderate. And they say, we don't have enough bodies for that. And I'm thinking, of course you have enough bodies for that. It's just, you'd be slightly less profitable if you had people doing content moderation. And in this instance, everybody's in a race towards profitability. Everybody's in a race towards meeting either the starting or the finish line, however you define it, on AI. But we need humans in the chain, because this technology is different than almost maybe any other technology in that even the people that create it don't totally understand how it works and that it keeps improving itself. But I'm for human oversight.
And we're going to talk to two researchers who can bring us into that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Shots, that was a wonderful conversation. Thank you. I would now like to introduce our next panelists, two of the world's leading AI researchers and developers, Dan Hendricks and Jan Tallon. Dan is the executive and research director of Center for AI Safety. He received his PhD in computer science from UC Berkeley after graduating from the University of Chicago. And Dan has quickly become an internationally respected researcher and thought leader on responsible AI. And Jan Tallon is a founding engineer of Skype and a board member of the Center for AI Safety. He serves on the advisory board at the United Nations, is an active investor, and has founded numerous organizations dedicated to responsible AI. So I want to welcome them up to the stage to continue our conversations. Thank you all so much for being here. And I also want to balance some of what we talked about with Senator Schatz about all the good that AI can do, because I think that's important. But you both have expressed concern about the safety. That's why you created the Center for AI Safety and the need to have safeguards in place, right? So I'd like to hear more from you, Dan, about the Center for AI Safety and your role with it.
Yeah, thank you. So the Center for AI Safety has three focus areas. One is technical research. That's where we're trying to empirically measure the risks associated with AI systems, or how intelligent are they? How intelligent are they likely to be in a year from now? We also focus on field building because we can't do all the research ourselves. So trying to engage more machine learning researchers and other relevant researchers from other areas, like people who work on GPUs, maybe they can help mitigate risks from AI. And then we focus on advisory and advocacy. One example would be this event in advising capacity. I also am at XAI, Elon Musk's AGI company, as their safety advisor. So there's a broad portfolio of things we do to try to manage risks from AI, because it's such a multifaceted problem. There's a lot of hats that one needs to wear.
And there's only so much time in the day. You obviously have a lot on your plate. You mentioned Elon Musk, you're the top AI advisor for him. You are a leading AI researcher in the world. Why CAIS? Why do you devote your time to this cause? Why is it so important to you?
I think there's a bit of a concentration of expertise in industry where most people who think a lot about AI are working at OpenAI, Anthropic, XAI, places like that. So consequently, when we're needing to talk about risk management and get into the nitty gritty, there aren't really many people around, or they're bound by confidentiality or non-disparagement agreements. And so it gets very tangled speaking honestly about these sorts of things. A lot of the reason I'm doing this is to just try and be helpful to all of you as a resource for intellectually understanding what the largest risk sources are, and then what are mitigations that are practical that we could bring to bear to handle this problem.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to hearing your perspective as someone who has really been at the forefront of new disruptive technologies like Skype. Where do you see the biggest opportunities with AI?
Two areas in AI that I am particularly enthusiastic about. One of them is healthcare, because first of all, AI is now getting there, clearly. You have to be cautious of confabulations and whatnot, but the latest generation of LLMs is to the level where it can be clearly helpful when it comes to advising on medical issues. And they're not going to get worse. They're going to get better and better. And the healthcare is an area that is non-threatening. A friend of mine says that you can take financial categories, economic categories from financial markets. There are something like a dozen of them. And only two of them will not freak you out if you imagine an international arms race in those. One is healthcare. The other one is agriculture. All the other things, defense, energy, finance, they're like a little bit scary when you think about an arms race. And the other area, which I see like less discussion about it, but I think it's more interesting, common epistemics. There's a lot of discussion about AI generated disinformation and deepfakes. I highly endorse what Schatz said, that we need to like label AI generated content. But there's flip side to this AI disinformation. The interesting thing that people have now accustomed to is that computers can talk now. Just 5-10 years ago, that would have been crazy science fiction. You can talk to computers and they make sense now. But the interesting thing is that they do not have an agenda, at least yet, which means that you can use large language models to steer a discourse. Just to give an example, a friend of mine has this habit of taking press releases and just asking Claude or ChatGPT, what did they actually say anything or not? So that's just one example. The other thing that you can do is that if you are part of a group of people that needs to like spend money on some preventive measure that is unlikely to be actually necessary because the risk is small, but you need to spend it, because if you don't do it, it's like an insurance kind of situation. But you're exposing yourself politically if you're spending on, I don't know, flood control or something like that, and then it turns out the flood doesn't come, right? But you can just ask LLM, is it reasonable right now to spend on flood control? And if LLM says that, yes, it is, it doesn't have an agenda to be reelected or something like that, then you can just like shift the blame to LLM.
That's a really interesting way to put it. It doesn't have an agenda, unlike humans. It also doesn't have emotions like humans do, right?
I hope so.
One should hope. I'm wondering what you think, Dan, from the conversation I had with Senator Schatz and what he said about companies like OpenAI, where he says they don't self-regulate, the way that they should, because they're just trying to like get ahead of every other company. And it's sort of an AI race right now. I wonder what you thought about that. If you see that to be the case, you released a statement, if I recall, with Sam Altman and other leaders expressing concern about AI and the need for safety. And if we don't make this a priority, it could lead to human extinction, right? I'm not overstating it, your concern. So what did you think about that?
Yeah, I think the competitive pressures in industry are very tremendous. Even if you are extremely interested in safety and highly risk averse, if you are trying to influence AI development by having a major AI lab, then to have influence in the first place, you're going to need to be able to afford the next generation supercomputer, which the cost of each of those maybe grows like 10x every year, roughly speaking. That means you're going to need to raise $10 billion. The next year, you're going to need to raise $100 billion. And that's why they have to move as quickly as they do. If they proceed more slowly, they will lose all influence. And although they really care about safety, it no longer matters. They're just outside of the arena. So I can sympathize with many of the AI labs that this is the predicament they're caught in. And so the statement where the DeepMind CEO, the OpenAI CEO, the Anthropic CEO, et cetera, signed on that the risks from AI could be even at the level of extinction at some point. And so we need to have this be a global priority alongside nuclear weapons and pandemics. It's at that sort of tier. I think a reason that they assigned that is because they're locked in this competitive arms race that they can't really do anything about. So that's why some governmental intervention is warranted. It's a collective action problem. They'd all like to do the safe thing, but the financial incentives are for them to cut corners on safety. So if there are requirements of all of them, then they don't need to cut corners on safety, and then we can proceed more responsibly.
Right. It's what you just laid out. It's a conflict of interest, right, for them to self-regulate if it hurts, you know, the bottom line. And so it raises the question, what does good regulation look like? Some states have tried. California just recently tried with its legislation to put safeguards in place, which many of the AI companies didn't like. They thought it was targeting the developers too much and not enough on, you know, those who could use it, bad actors to cause harm. What do you think, Jan, in terms of what good regulation should look like?
I just like would echo what Senator Schatz and Dan just said that, like, I've been in this, like, AI safety area for, like, 15 years now. And my kind of plan all along has been to kind of invest in AI companies and then, like, philanthropically support nonprofits that are doing the homework of these AI companies and then kind of, like, put everyone in a friendly manner together. And then we can just solve all humanity's problems. But it didn't work.
A good mission though, right?
Yeah. It was very plausible in the beginning. But yeah, now basically people are in this, the leading AI companies are just in this cutthroat arms race, basically. And they just can't do what they kind of like would want to do as people. Therefore, I think it's really important to kind of have like an external referee
to help out.
But
I think, as I was just talking with the senator about, AI is developing so rapidly, Congress does not work at a rapid pace. And so what do you do in this period, right? When AI is just happening right before our eyes every day and impacting every part of our lives and developing so quickly, what do you do in this space? I mean, I remember ChatGPT came out and then the next level of that came out, and that's just the tip of the iceberg, it seems.
Yeah. So I think it is possible for governmental entities to acquire or amass a lot of technical talent to estimate the risks from cutting edge systems. So for instance, the UK AI Safety Institute has many dozens of people who are from some of the major labs who are fortunately working in government. So I think it can be done. I think also the Biden AI executive order was very competently drafted. So certainly our institutions can sometimes be slow, but I think we've had several instances of our institutions getting it and being able to keep on top of it.
If you look at the global scale, you have the competition between the companies here in the U.S., right, tech companies, but also countries competing, Russia and China competing with the U.S. and elsewhere. I'm wondering, Jan, what your concern is about that, particularly as it relates to those lethal autonomous weapons.
This is obviously like very, very complex topic.
Of course.
And as I said, and one of the meetings that I've been having here in Washington, D.C., is that when I grew up in Soviet-occupied country in Estonia and listened to like Voice of America from my grandfather's radio. And I'm kind of eternally thankful for the like non-recognition policy that US had. But like even in the height of the Cold War, there was discussions and negotiations and treaties being made in areas where there was clearly like common interest between the adversaries. And I do think it's kind of like really important to keep that line open, because there obviously are common interests between even the US and China that like we shouldn't just brush aside because of the very justifiable national interest. For example, indeed the lethal autonomous weapons, like one of the tools that I have in my toolset is extrapolation. Just like look at not at the current generation of AIs, but from what I see, what the next generation is going to be, and then just extrapolate like where this thing is going. If I look at lethal autonomous weapons, the trend is smarter, faster, smaller, which means that the end of it is robots that you can't see anymore, and that just like fill the atmosphere. And you don't know, just like in cyberspace, it's very hard to attribute. You don't really know who controls them. And it's very possible that most of them are under like non-state actors' control. So this is clearly an area that like big states, including US and China, should have like a vested interest to make sure that they wouldn't be just like inadvertently equipping non-state actors.
I think you raise an important point. There's the state actors, which we talked a lot about, but the non-state actors as well, who could take down a power grid potentially, or do things that could really impact our lives day to day on a grand scale. I want to hear more from you about that as we wrap this up. And also, I'd be remiss not to ask about jobs. I think we all want to know like where we're going to be 5-10 years from now when it comes to the job front.
Yeah, so I think a point of international agreement could be on making sure that non-state actors don't maliciously use these AI systems to cause catastrophes or build weapons of mass destruction. So if there are AIs that are expert level virologists, releasing those willy-nilly to anybody who wants them is, I think, quite hazardous because they could just repurpose them to create a bioweapon. So that type of proliferation of skill for creating weapons is a way in which AI is a threat amplifier. And AI can be a threat amplifier to cyber attacks as well. So critical infrastructure is very slowly patched. One has to be fairly sophisticated to take down a power grid, though. However, the barriers to that may decrease substantially as AIs become more intelligent. So if they're better at performing cyber attacks in the future, and anybody can perform a cyber attack, all you have to do is jailbreak a model and instruct it to do so, then we have national security issues on our hands. So the type of legislation and regulation that I think is most promising, because it's bipartisan and it's addressing things that everybody says it shouldn't happen, is legislation handling national security risks. I think some other type of legislation that would be useful is us just getting a handle on these AI chips. These high-end AI chips are what underlie all of the progress in AI. That's what they're fundraising for. They're spending 90% plus of their budget on buying more NVIDIA chips. So I think we should try and get a handle on that so that non-state actors don't get them, or so our adversaries don't get them. Then we won't be caught in this really pernicious arms race dynamic that the companies are seeing themselves in. If we have a strong lead over China, then we don't need to be behaving in that way. There won't be an external referee to help us out if we're in a really close competition with China. So I think that's one reason why focusing on chips and export controls is a very promising intervention. And then as for automation, that's maybe a bit farther down the line. One could speculate maybe some type of tax to help workers who have been displaced by this technology, maybe a compute tax or value-added tax. But although we're talking about longer-term risks here, I'm sort of maybe we'll procrastinate a little bit on that and see what the facts of the matter are as that starts to happen.
We'll kick the can down the road on that. All right. Well, thank you all so much. This was great. Jan, Dan, Varun, thank you all for this really meaningful and important conversation, helping us better understand AI and the safety around it. I encourage everyone to take what we discussed up here, go forth and enjoy networking and having a cocktail and enjoy the rest of the evening. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.